You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume Number 4, by Rudolf Steiner, a revised translation of Michael Wilson's Philosophy of Freedom by Rudolf Steiner. And this is Chapter 10, entitled Philosophy of Freedom and Monism. The naive person who acknowledges as real only what he can see with his eyes and grasp with his hands also requires for his moral life a basis for action perceptible to the senses. He requires someone or something to impart the basis for his action to him in a way that his senses can understand. He is ready to allow this basis for action to be dictated to him as commandments by any person whom he considers wiser or more powerful than himself, or whom he acknowledges, for some other reason, to be a power over him. In this way there arise as moral principles the authority of family, state, society, church, and God, as previously described. An individual who is very narrow-minded still puts his faith in some one person. The more advanced individual allows his moral conduct to be dictated by a majority, (state, society). It is always on perceptible powers that he builds. The person who awakens at last to the conviction that basically these powers are human beings as weak as himself seeks guidance from a higher power, from a divine being, whom he endows, however, with sense-perceptible features. He conceives this being as communicating to him the conceptual content of his moral life, again, in a perceptible way. Whether it be, for example, that God appears in the burning bush, or that he moves about among people in manifest human shape, and that their ears can hear him telling them what to do and what not to do. The highest stage of development of naive realism in the sphere of morality is that where the moral commandment, (moral idea), is separated from every being other than oneself and is thought of, hypothetically, as being an absolute power in one's own inner life. What man first took to be the external voice of God, he now takes as an independent power within him, and speaks of this inner voice in such a way as to identify it with conscience. But in doing this, he has already gone beyond the stage of naive consciousness, into the sphere where the moral laws have become independently existing standards. There they are no longer carried by real bearers, but have become metaphysical entities existing in their own right. They are analogous to the invisible, visible forces, of metaphysical realism, which does not seek reality through the part of it that man has in his thinking, but hypothetically adds it on to actual experience. These extra-human moral standards always occur as accompanying features of metaphysical realism. For metaphysical realism is bound to seek the origin of morality in the sphere of extra-human reality. Here there are several possibilities. If the hypothetically assumed entity is conceived as in itself unthinking, acting according to purely mechanical laws, as materialism would have it, then it must also produce, out of itself, by purely mechanical necessity, the human individual with all his characteristic features. The consciousness of freedom can then be nothing more than an illusion. For though I consider myself the author of my action, it is the matter of which I am composed, and the movements going on in it that are working in me. I believe myself free, but in fact all my actions are nothing but the result of the material processes which underlie my physical and mental organization. It is said that we have the feeling of freedom only because we do not know the motives compelling us. Quote, "We must emphasize that the feeling of freedom is due to the absence of external compelling motives. Our action is necessitated, as is our thinking." Close quote. Another possibility is that a person may picture the extra-human absolute that lies behind the world of appearances as a spiritual being. In this case, he will also seek the impulse for his actions in a corresponding spiritual force. He will see the moral principles to be found in his own reason as the expression of this being itself, which has its own special intentions with regard to man. To this kind of dualist, the moral laws appear to be dictated by the absolute, and all that man has to do is to use his intelligence to find out the decisions of the absolute being and then carry them out. The moral world order appears to the dualist as the perceptible reflection of a higher order standing behind it. Earthly morality is the manifestation of the extra-human world order. It is not man that matters in this moral order, but the being itself, that is, the extra-human entity. Man shall do as this being wills. Edward von Hartmann, who imagines this being itself as a godhead, whose very existence is a life of suffering, believes that this divine being has created the world in order thereby to gain release from his infinite suffering. Hence, this philosopher regards the moral evolution of humanity as a process which is there for the redemption of God. Quote, "Only through the building up of a moral world order by intelligent, self-conscious individuals can the world process be led toward its goal. True existence is the incarnation of the Godhead. The world process is the passion of the incarnated Godhead, and at the same time, the way of redemption for him who was crucified in the flesh. Morality, however, is the collaboration in the shortening of this path of suffering and redemption." Close quote. Here, man does not act because he wants to, but he shall act because it is God's will to be redeemed. Whereas the materialistic dualist makes man an automaton whose actions are only the result of a purely mechanical system, the spiritualistic dualist, parenthesis, that is, one who sees the absolute, the being in itself, as something spiritual, in which man has no share in his conscious experience, close parenthesis, makes him a slave to the will of the absolute. As in materialism, so also in one-sided spiritualism, in fact in any kind of metaphysical realism, inferring but not experiencing something extra-human as the true reality. Freedom is out of the question. metaphysical as well as naive realism, consistently followed out, must deny freedom for one and the same reason. They both see man as doing no more than putting into effect or carrying out principles forced upon him by necessity. Naive realism destroys freedom by subjecting man to the authority of a perceptible being, or of one conceived on the analogy of a perceptible being, or eventually to the authority of the abstract inner voice which it interprets as conscience. The metaphysician, who merely infers the extra-human reality, cannot acknowledge freedom, because he sees man as being determined, mechanically or morally, by a, quote, being in itself, close quote. Monism will have to recognize that naive realism is partially justified, because it recognizes the justification of the world of percepts. Whoever is incapable of producing moral ideas through intuition must accept them from others. Insofar as a man receives his moral principles from without, he is in fact unfree. But monism attaches as much significance to the idea as to the percept. The idea, however, can come to manifestation in the human individual. Insofar as man follows the impulses coming from this side, he feels himself to be free. But monism denies all justification to a metaphysics that merely draws inferences, and consequently it also rejects the impulses of action derived from so-called beings in themselves. According to the monistic view, man may act unfreely when he obeys some perceptible external compulsion. He can act freely when he obeys none but himself. Monism cannot recognize any unconscious compulsion hidden behind percept and concept. If anyone asserts that the action of a fellow man is done unfreely, then he must identify the thing, or the person, or the institution within which the perceptible world that has caused the person to act. And if he bases his assertion upon causes of action lying outside the world that is real to the senses and the spirit, then monism can take no notice of it. According to the monistic view, then, human actions are partly unfree, partly free. The human being finds himself to be unfree in the world of percepts, and he realizes within himself the free spirit. The moral laws which the metaphysician, who works by mere inference, must regard as issuing from a higher power, are, for the adherent of monism, thoughts of human beings. For him, the moral world order is neither the imprint of a purely mechanical natural order, nor that of an extra-human world order, but, through and through, the free creation of human beings. It is not the will of some being outside him in the world that man has to carry out, but his own. He puts into effect his own resolves and intentions, not those of another being. Monism does not see, behind man's actions, the purposes of a supreme directorate, foreign to him and determining him according to its will, but rather sees that people, insofar as they realize their intuitive ideas, pursue only their own human ends. Moreover, each individual pursues his own particular ends. For the world of ideas comes to expression not in a group of people, but only in individuals. What appears as the common goal of a whole group of people is only the result of the separate acts of will of its individual members, and in fact usually of a few outstanding ones, who, as their authorities, are followed by the others. Each one of us has it in turn to be a free spirit, just as every rosebud has in it a rose. Monism, then, in the sphere of true moral action, is a freedom philosophy. Since it is a philosophy of reality, it rejects the metaphysical, unreal restrictions of the free spirit as completely as it accepts the physical and historical, naively real, restrictions of the naive person. Since it does not consider man as a finished product, disclosing his full nature in every moment of his life, it regards the dispute as to whether man as such is free or not to be of no consequence. It sees in man a developing being, and asks whether, in the course of this development, the stage of the free spirit can be reached. Monism knows that nature does not send man forth from her arms ready-made as a free spirit, but that she leads him up to a certain stage, from which he continues to develop still as an unfree being, until he comes to the point where he finds his own self. Monism is quite clear that a being acting under physical or moral compulsion cannot be a truly moral being. It regards the phases of automatic behavior, following natural urges and instincts, and of obedient behavior, following moral standards, as necessary preparatory stages of morality. But it also sees that both these transitory stages can be overcome by the free spirit. Monism frees the truly moral world conception both from the mundane fetters of naive moral maxims and from the transcendental moral maxims of the speculative metaphysician. Monism can no more eliminate the former from the world than it can eliminate percepts. It rejects the latter because it seeks all the principles for the elucidation of the world phenomena within that world, and none outside it. Just as monism refuses even to think of principles of knowledge other than those that apply to individual human beings, see pages 106-107, so it emphatically rejects even the thought of moral maxims other than those that apply to people. Human morality, like human knowledge, is conditioned by human nature. And just as beings of a different order will understand knowledge to mean something very different from what it means to us, so will other beings have a different morality from ours. Morality is for the monist a specifically human quality, and spiritual freedom as the human way of being moral. That's the end of the book as it was before 1918. Here is the author's editions from 1918. Number 1. In forming a judgment about the argument of the two preceding chapters, a difficulty can arise in that one appears to be faced with a contradiction. On the one hand, we have spoken of the experience of thinking, which is felt to have universal significance and is equally valid for every human consciousness. On the other hand, we have shown that the ideas which come to realization in the moral life and are of the same kind as those elaborated in thinking come to expression in each human consciousness in a quite individual way. If we cannot get beyond regarding this antithesis as a, quote, contradiction, close quote, and if we do not see that in the living recognition of this actually existing antithesis, a piece of man's essential nature reveals itself, then we shall be unable to see either the idea of knowledge or the idea of freedom in a true light. For those who think of their concepts as merely abstracted from the sense-perceptible world and do not allow intuition its rightful place, this thought here claimed as a reality must remain a mere contradiction. If we really understand how ideas are intuitively experienced in their self-sustaining essence, it becomes clear that in the act of knowing, man, on the edge of the world of ideas, lives his way into something which is the same for all people. But when, from this world of ideas, he derives the intuitions for his acts of will, he individualizes a part of this world by the same activity that he practices as a universal human one in the spiritual ideal process of knowing. What appears to be a logical contradiction, the universal nature of cognitive ideas and the individual nature of moral ideas, is the very thing that, when seen in its reality, becomes a living concept. It is a characteristic feature of the essential nature of man that what can be intuitively grasped swings to and fro within man like a living pendulum between universally valid knowledge and the individual experience of it. For those who cannot see the one half of the swing in its reality, thinking remains only a subjective human activity. For those who cannot grasp the other half, man's activity in thinking will seem to lose all individual life. To the first kind of thinker, it is the act of knowing that is unintelligible. To the second kind, it is the moral life. Both will put forward all sorts of imagined ways of explaining the one or the other, all equally unfounded, either because they entirely fail to grasp that thinking can be actually experienced, or because they misunderstand it as a merely abstracting activity. Number 2. On page 147, I have spoken of materialism. I am well aware that there are thinkers, such as Tsihin, mentioned above, who do not call themselves materialists at all, but who must nevertheless be described as such from the point of view put forward in this book. The point is not whether someone says that for him the world is not restricted to merely material existence, and that therefore he is no materialist, but whether he develops concepts that are applicable only to material existence. Anyone who says, quote, "our action is necessitated as is our thinking," close quote, has implied a concept that is applicable only to material processes, but not to action or to being. And if he were to think his concept through to the end, he could not help but think materialistically. He avoids doing this only by the same inconsistency that so often results from not thinking one's thoughts through to the end. It is often said nowadays that the materialism of the 19th century is outmoded in knowledgeable circles, but in fact this is not at all true. It is only that nowadays people so often fail to notice that they have no other ideas but those with which one can approach only material things. Thus, recent materialism is veiled, whereas in the second half of the 19th century it showed itself openly. The veiled materialism of the present is no less intolerant of an outlook that grasps the world spiritually than was the self-confessed materialism of the last century. but it deceives many who think they have a right to reject a view of the world which takes spirit into account on the ground that the scientific view, quote, has long ago abandoned materialism, close quote. The end of chapter 10.